Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this post-show expert panel, and thank you for coming to see Disorder Contained. I guess before we begin, I should introduce the panel that we have here. I think the easiest thing to do is just begin in sequence. So just beside me here, I have William Murphy. He's part of this project on the history of prisoner health, and William's specialism is on the history of political imprisonment. He's done work on Belfast prison as well, but he specializes in the revolutionary period. To his right is Derek Nisbet. Derek is a co-founder and co-artistic director of Talking Birds, a Coventry-based theater company which put on tonight's show. To Derek's right is Associate Professor Catherine Cox from UCD, and beside her is Professor Hilary Marland from Warwick University. And the play you've seen tonight is based on their research onto prisons in England and Ireland in the 1840s and the introduction of the separate system at that time. And just at the end there is Genevieve Say, who is one of the performers you saw tonight, prisoner 52, and the school teacher. So just before I open the floor to your questions, I'll just begin by asking the panel to address the process whereby the kind of historical research is turned into a theatrical production. So for Hilary and Catherine, this is, well, it's Hilary's third time working with Talking Birds, and Catherine's second in collaboration with Hilary. And they began doing work on the trade in lunacy, the early 18th century private lunatic asylums. And then also did their second play, The Malady of Migration, was on the migration of Irish people to Lanarkshire and how they ended up in asylums there. So I guess just to begin tonight, if you could kind of relate this process of working with a theatre company like Talking Birds, how that process happens and what value do you think it adds to your own research? So Hilary or Catherine to begin.
Who wants to? Well, should I just start talking about the sources? Because all of this, well, the script is based very much on our archival work. So the materials that we've gathered for both of this prison project, but also the previous work on migration and mental illness, was based very much on materials we collected in local archives. For the play tonight, it was things like the chaplain's journal, medical journals, minute books, official reports, prison memoirs, a whole range of materials. And then we worked very closely with director and scriptwriter Peter Cann, and he unfortunately can't be here in Belfast tonight. He creates the script, we work with him on the script, and then we participate in the rehearsals. So the result is based very intensively on archival materials, but it's really mediated by Peter, who brings his own interpretation to much of the material. So it's very much a collaborative process, which involved the entire team really working quite closely together.
Yeah, not sure much to add to that. I mean, the research you'll gather from the play, it's not any one particular prison, because we gave a huge amount of research material to Peter to read. And we drew on sources from, you know, for Pentonville Prison in London, for Liverpool Borough Prison in Liverpool, surprise, surprise, for Mountjoy Prison in Dublin, also some material on Sligo Prison. So it's very much a collection of source material, but all of, I suppose, what those prisons have in common is basically they introduced a separate system at some stage in that key period of the 1840s and 50s. And then I guess after that, we very much hand it over to the artistic team to interpret it as they wish. And that's what I'm going to do now, Derek.
Yes. We had this early discussions around the subject. This is the third part of a trilogy, so we've kind of developed a working method. So starting with conversations around the subject, okay, prisons and mental health, probably the first idea was from the designer Janet Vaughan, who appropriately enough, where we're sitting, came up with the idea of this table, which because it's not just about the prisoners, it's about those other characters that make decisions about their lives. Also, other characters outside the prison, the relatives that particularly the women, who is in a way absent and present in the story. So the table was representing the kind of place where decisions were made, where reports were read, but also transforms into the cell and sort of represents the dimensions of the cell. And that was the starting idea before any script, and then the script emerged from there.
And Jen, I wonder, could you address that kind of thing? How does it work for you in terms of making this kind of, I guess, embodying this kind of historical person, the historical characters or amalgams? How do you bring that to life?
Well, it's a really interesting process for us, because it means that we've got something tangible that we can work from, but it doesn't stop us being able to play with filling in the gaps as to what that character would be. So we get lots of documentation and research from these guys, which is amazing, which is, you know, it's quite factual. It's based on statistics, it's based on journals, so it's from particular perspectives, and inevitably that's going to have gaps in it in terms of who those people really were. So our job is to sort of fill in those holes and create something that feels like rounded human beings for you to engage with and sympathise with or not, but have some sort of an emotional response to, because you're able to see like human beings on stage. It's quite a tricky process though, and it's, you know, in rehearsals it's quite hit and miss, and we have to try stuff out, and we have to allow that not to work and then try something else out, and see what the dynamics are between the different characters. And it's all, it, you know, for us it's really brilliant because it's something we can get our teeth into.
Thank you so much. Okay, so I'm just going to open it up to the audience now. I should say that the mic I'm holding won't make you any louder, but I will ask you to use it if you're asking a question or making a comment. It's simply for recording purposes. So if you'd like to ask something of the panel, you could maybe raise your hand and I'll come around to you with the mic. It's always a bit... the first one, the brave soul. Oh, thank you.
My name is Paul Darrow, and I'm interested in the history of medicine, but I'm a doctor, and I worked in the prison, so I've quite a breadth of experience in this. And one of the things that I have been thinking about when I was coming to this here was, have we moved on? I'm not sure we have. I think this, our mental, our prisons are full of people who probably should not be in prison at all. They need some other sort of solution. So that's just a quick reflection to get the ball rolling.
Can I ask you a question, Paul, actually?
Sure.
Because obviously, you know me, and we're sort of, I'd be more familiar with the current situation in the Republic of Ireland in terms of the use of solitary confinement and things like that. What's the usage up in Northern Ireland at the moment in the prison system? Is solitary confinement used?
Solitary confinement, yes. I mean, that's. I used to have to go down to the confinement unit and see these people, and you know, there, but for the grace of God, you felt, go I.
So they're still using solitary confinement.
Well, as far as I know, I haven't been there for 10 years, but it certainly was a feature, and often it may not even be imposed as a punishment. It may be the individual requests it. So for protection, all sorts of issues come up.
I currently work in the Northern Ireland Prison Service, but I work for the health service and up. So I work as one of the leads in mental health and addictions in prisons here, and they do still use what has been referred to here as solitary confinement, although they use a different language with it. It's shorter term based than maybe the play But as Dr. Dara has said, a lot of our people who access that space, very often they choose to, because it's for multiple reasons. And it's quite a complex place for a person, because it's not always something, maybe they don't initially choose it, but then they're there for a while. And as you guys reflected really well, their journeys in that solitude. And you get to a stage with a lot of the people that I work with where they don't want to leave that space. So it's difficult to sort of work them out. And you also, you see like a double institutionalisation. You see them institutionalised within that space and within a prison. And as Dr. Dara said as well, prison is not the place for people who have mental health and addiction issues. Unfortunately, our society here don't always have the support within the wider community to support those people, and they end up coming into prison. So
thank you
for what it's worth.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Well, I think what you see in some prison environments as well is that people are not, prisoners not put in separate confinement or segregation, but they're ineffective segregation. And that occurs in many prisons in the UK, where prisoners are kept in their cells 23 hours a day because there aren't enough staff to support them and enough activities going on within the prison. So I think, it's as you say, it's quite a complex issue, but I think there's a lot of effective segregation. It's very noisy.
It's very noisy.
Yeah, a little fight the noise. There's a lot of effective segregation, even if it isn't part of a kind of system or regime.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Oh, sorry.
Sort of continue with the same theme. I'm a consultant psychiatrist, so I work in a psychiatric hospital, and we do see many of the same individuals between prison and the hospital. They move between prison and hospital, maybe the same individuals. So it's just what Dr. Dars already said, that these individuals were the best place, and clearly prison isn't very helpful for most of these people. Clearly it's not. But I couldn't help reflect when I was watching the play, which is excellent. It's really good, very well acted, and based entirely on true stories, I'm assuming, or approximations of true stories. That this isn't just of historic interest, and in particular in the United States of America at the present time. I mean, thousands or maybe tens of thousands of people are condemned to solitary confinement for life as a punishment, and they will never escape from it. And it's just horrific, the thought of it, and the way it's described in the play, the induction of hallucinations and delusions, which inevitably results for the vast majority of people who are in those circumstances. I mean, that's what's happening on the planet today. It may not be happening in Northern Ireland to the same extent, but it's certainly happening on the planet. Which is horrific in the 21st century.
I think that's quite interesting how, I mean, obviously we've this play has been performed in England in Coventry. It was in Dublin then from Wednesday to, what day is today? Friday. And now today it's in Belfast. And I think the responses, it doesn't seem to matter which healthcare system you're sort of operating in, which prison system you're sort of talking about, there are continuities that seem to apply to all these systems. And yeah, the just a constant theme of how it resonates with issues today in so many countries.
And I think the figure for the United States is roughly equivalent to the entire prison population of the UK. I think it's about 80,000 prisoners in solitary confinement in the US. So it's phenomenally high.
Hi, my name's Aoife, and I'm a prison researcher in the South in UCD. I'm doing my PhD. And my own research is looking at the difference between genders in prison. So I was just wondering, has gender come up either with the researchers, with the actors? Because we know that solitary confinement impacts women much differently than it does for men. So just like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I suppose I'll just talk about the history briefly. Leanne would probably actually be a better place to talk about women in prisons, but I'll just try it. You can correct me as I go wrong. Women were placed in the separate system in the period we're talking about, and we're focusing very much on the 1840s, 1850s sort of narrow period. But often it was for a shorter period. So Pentonville originally, people were put in separation for 18 months. By the time it hits, say, Mountjoy, it's reduced for men for 9 months, but for women it's 4 months. So you sort of have this, it's a different length of time, basically, for women. There's also this sense that for women it's they're not able for it. So the idea that a robust prisoner can go through this system and come out reformed, and therefore the assumption is that women are somehow less robust to start with, even before they get into the system. So you see this process sometimes of the easing of the regime to facilitate, but that's not necessarily a good thing, because of course that's underpinned by a whole load of assumptions about the biological and psychological makeup of women in this period. So yes, you have women in the system, but it is subtly different.
It's probably one of the only situations where women have come out better, in a better situation, because of sexist approaches.
Yeah, it's rather good to be regarded as weak.
Yeah. Yes, I'm really weak. Yeah.
Just in relation to men and women in prison, the one thing that struck me most about the prison was how few women are actually incarcerated compared to the number of men. And I think women, you know, if it's just about violence, I think women and men, they're both capable of quite a lot of violence. And yet we manage as a society to create other dispositions or disposals for people who are heading towards prison.
Thank you. Would the panel like to address a comment?
Yeah, I mean, the situation for women varies quite a lot in different prisons, and I think the overall rate was it was less than 20% of the prison population in the 19th century were women. We did quite a lot of work on Liverpool Borough Jail, and that's quite interesting because there were a large number of women prisoners there. I think it's one of the highest rates in Europe.
Yeah.
But many, of course, came in on for short-term offences. A lot of the women in prison were prostitutes, often quite young women, brought in on charges of drunken disorderly. So those were a different kind of prison population. They were in and out of the system quite quickly, and they may have had very little in the way of solitary
separation, yeah,
imposed upon them. And some of them came in a phenomenal number of times. Yeah. They were sort of in and out and in and out, and some of them were committed more than 100 times.
I work on the Bad Bridget project, and we have a lot of Irish women in and out of prison, well over 100 times, just in and out, and that's all they seem to do. It's prison becomes like the most stable feature, you know, and it's records of alcoholism, abuse, domestic violence, and this is where women have like their bed and board is behind the walls of prisons and other institutions.
And are you looking at the material in America?
So it's North America. It's between Boston, New York, and Toronto. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the stuff is amazing. How you figure this out, you know, for public engagement, because we're sort of going into that sort of part of our project now. I have a lot of ideas to be drawn from it. It's marvellous.
Thanks very much. Thanks. So any other comments or questions? Yeah, sure.
Just while we're talking about women and the gender thing, I just want to know why the production was conducted with three women.
That's a good question.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. On the one hand, it's three actors. So, and actually, yeah, there was a point in which, as it's the part of part three of a trilogy, and the previous parts have been mixed gender cast, and there was a point where we had the decision to make. What we wanted was some continuity in the cast, and actually Jill has been in all three parts, Teresa has been two parts, and Jen has joined us for this one. But Partly there was a pragmatic decision about the third part, but there was also we felt actually we could do more with it, actually, if we sort of cut loose from any literalism about and actually explore the characters with in a freer way, and also perhaps a little bit of distance, and also very much the fact that these are stories about men, but obviously women were involved, but they're just not part of that sort of the usual narrative. So it's a kind of way of addressing those different things, and but yeah, and also that thing of like actors can do those things, and actually just that whole being literal about casting, we've never subscribed to, because you know why. You know, so it was about sort of that was, I don't know if you got a...
I think now is we live in an age that's really interesting now, where we seem to have got to this place where we've accepted the fact that most things that have been written historically have been written for men, about men, and men have played those roles. And recently, we've seen really high-profile productions of women playing men's roles, and it's gone down really well, and sort of been proved that that can happen, and it doesn't, you know, theatrical structures don't get destroyed because of it, and we can still buy into that as an audience. So I think, for me, it's really interesting theatrically to just play with that as a thing, where women can play men can play women, and we can trust in an audience. As long as we're doing our job as actors, we can trust in an audience to, you know, understand what's going on there.
And there may be a bit of it, sorry.
As an audience member, I find myself kind of going, oh, like this, you know. It challenged me, actually, and, you know, I would love to have seen Glenda Jackson performing King Lear, was it? Yeah. I mean, I'm all for that, and I'm very supportive of that. But I have to say, as an audience member, it kind of made me go, oh my goodness, I was so expecting men, because I knew this was about men. So thank you for challenging me again.
You're welcome.
Did you settle into it, though?
Oh, yeah.
Or did it?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I just ask the panel a question? I was really struck in the performance by the influence of the preacher-pastor element of that, and how that sort of, the weight of that compared to the sort of the medical person, and when that influence shifted, and how much it shifted, you know, even sort of thinking that in relatively recent years in America, the DSM still classified homosexuality in terms of a mental illness, and they haven't yet sort of maybe redressed that in terms of apology. So there's still the weight of the that sort of biblical influence and mental health. Convoluted question.
Yeah, I mean, the chaplain was very, very important in this whole system of separate confinement. I mean, they were very supportive of it in general, and I think very committed to it. So although Merriweather was a real zealot and very extreme in the way he, you know, dealt with the prisoners, there was an element of commitment, I think, on the part of chaplains. And they also claimed ascendancy, in a way, if you like, in being able to judge the prisoners' state of mind and to deal with their moral condition, of course. So there was a kind of pecking order in prisons, and the doctor was probably usually much lower down in that pecking order, also in terms of payment. But it's fair to say the chaplains varied a great deal. So we do find more sympathetic chaplains, even in the 19th century, and that prisoner memoirs speak quite favourably of them, that they were very supportive and genuinely kind. But there was certainly the more extreme form of chaplain as well. And Pentonville did have a resignation because the chaplain became associated with religious mania. He offered his resignation, and to his surprise, it was accepted. And I don't know if you want to say something about the Irish.
I mean, in the, you know, the chaplain's ascendancy is sort of, you know, eventually reduced, as it were. I mean, it's not removed, but certainly his significance becomes reduced. And of course, in the Irish context, as we all know, that those accusations of the potential or the anxieties around proselytism, stroke conversionism, that filtered into the prison system as well. So you have in many of the Irish prisons, there was a first of all requirement to have a Roman Catholic and a Church of Ireland chaplain. There was also, as we're familiar with, that concern about the overlap between education mm-hmm. and religious belief and proselytism and all those sort of accusations that whipped around in the 19th century. So the relationship between the school teacher and the chaplain in the Irish system was different. I mean, in Pentonville, as it was originally, where separatism was originally sort of developed, the idea was the chaplain would guide the school teacher in many matters and determine, as we saw, what was read, what wasn't read. By the time it hits Mountjoy, there's a clear statement that these roles in an Irish context have to be separate, that really you can't have the chaplain of either faith interfering with the actual, too much, with the school teacher. So there's a greater separation there. And then, of course, in places like Belfast, where you have a larger Presbyterian population, you have a Presbyterian chaplain. So there's more variation in the Irish system and a slightly different relationship between the different officers.
I just wanted to ask a question of William.
There's no need for
him. Huh?
It's fine, I'm tired.
Afraid not, Ray. It's part of the contract.
But
in wine only. So just a question I have is, of course, health is very significant for political prisoners, or those who seek political status is brought into play through hunger strike, whatever. Do you think they would have had or had much sympathy for ordinary prisoners held in such conditions?
That varied, to be honest. Many of the Irish nationalists...
You actually need to stop.
Do I need to look this way? I do. Many of the Irish nationalist prisoners in the 19th century and into the early 20th century, who I'm familiar with, had very little empathy and sympathy with the ordinary prisoner. In fact, what they were, I probably don't need to tell an audience here, what they were often most concerned to do was separate themselves from the ordinary prisoner and distinguish themselves from them. But having said that, political prisoner memoirs were probably, they were one of the influences which exposed the dangers of the separate system in the 19th century when you start getting Fenian prison memoirs, etc. And they're, decrying the effects of the system and very evocatively describing the mental effects the system has. So they are looking to be relieved of separation, partly because, they want to protect their own mental health, partly because they want to, be separate from the other prisoners, and then also the key thing for political prisoners is they want to organise inside. So association is absolutely crucial for them. It's not just about protecting their own mental well-being, it's about, furthering the cause inside as well as outside. So in that way they're quite different, but they do have some relationship to the development of the separate system and indeed the decline of it, I suppose.
And many of them became mentally ill, didn't they? There are quite a few examples.
Right in the period, the mid-19th century, but right through into the revolutionary period in 19-teens that I'm very familiar with. There are prisoners from Frongoch being, for instance, transferred to the local asylum in Wales, and prisoners who transferred to London being transferred into Broadmoor, etc. So, prison is obviously a tough place, and even when prisoners have association, sometimes that's not enough to protect them from the rigors of the experience.
Just thinking, when we know that in the main women do much shorter sentences than men, but I was thinking about that separation from children, and particularly for women. And I know with working in the past with some women who had been jailed in Northern Ireland for long periods of time during the Troubles, there was separation from children as well. I'm just wondering the effects on mental health. Is there a difference noticed between how women see that separation as how men see that separation, or is that something that hasn't really been looked at in a particular way?
Well, I mean, certainly for men, you do actually see a lot of anxiety about sort of the loss of. I mean, we have, I suppose, researched men more than women at the moment, because the vast majority, as we've said, of the population were men. And you see a lot of anxiety about the loss of contact with family members. As the play demonstrated, there was some, you know, permissions to maintain those connections, but they were very limited. And you often see people sort of having, or you read about them having, experiencing delusions that are related to sort of loss of contact with mothers and with wives, and sort of the loneliness of that definitely comes true. There's also attempts, I suppose, that, you know, or when women give birth or come in with a child, there are some attempts to keep them together in the 19th century. You probably know more about this than me, or move them to a secondary institution where they will be sort of allowed to have some contact with the child. But yeah,
but some contacts were broken forever. I mean, one of the memoirs that was drawn on in this play, the memoir of Florence Maybrick, she was actually sentenced to 15 years in prison. And that was it in terms of contact with her children. I mean, she was quite well-to-do and literate, and she wrote beautiful memoirs, and there's some actual direct quotations from her work in the play. But she was separated from the children, and after she left prison, there was no more contact with them. So in many cases, that was a complete rupture, I think, for women. We know very little, really, about what happened to the children who were left outside prison. Presumably many ended up in workhouses, some might have been cared for by other family members, but the records are quite silent on that aspect.
You come across one or two instances of, you know, somebody gives birth and what happens to the child, but that they're again, you probably know they're unusual.
So for the North American records, you only know that maybe there is a child because scrawled at, you know, the corner of the page, let's say, and child 3 months old, but we don't know how long that child was in there for. There's also, though, it can be added also in the margin that after the child has been there for a few months, that it has that died as well. So I think it's really hard to get as much evidence as you can because these are just scrawled in the margins of things. But for those who did end up there with their mothers, I think a large proportion of them did eventually just die as a result of the conditions of the prison itself.
And what's quite interesting, actually, is we get quite a bit about, I've come across quite a lot looking at Mountjoy, is actually mothers looking for their sons. So they're writing into this to the prison looking for, you know, my darling John. And sometimes my darling John has been moved to Dundrum Lunatic Asylum. So then the officers go to try and search those records. And sometimes they don't find them because they've actually escaped from Dundrum Lunatic Asylum. But you see a lot of sort of mothers trying to track their own family members, which, you know, is quite interesting. But it's not a huge amount of information that we have. They're snippets.
And there's quite a lot on women giving birth in prison and their conditions, and quite a lot of efforts to improve conditions in the late 19th, early 20th century. I'm not quite sure how extensive the practice was in the UK and Ireland of manacling women when they give birth, which I believe is still done in the United States. I don't know what they expect women to do when they're giving birth, but anyway, they still are often in manacles as they give birth, which is pretty horrendous.
Can I just make a comment on the modern day situation? What we find generally in the South, and I presume it'll happen in the North as well, is that men, what people will tell you is that when men go into prison, somebody else is looking after the child in the community. So very often they weren't the primary caregivers in the community. So it might have been maybe an ex-girlfriend, perhaps even their mother, somebody else. They might have children with a number of partners. While they will talk about the hardship of being in prison and missing their child, the women seem to feel that far more intensely than the men, because nowadays, for example, the women will have, they may have children to a number of partners, but they're the primary caregivers usually. So we find when women go into prison now that unless their parents, unless the woman's parents take the children into their own custody, the children end up in care. Whereas the same doesn't happen for the men. So there's that, like women feel it far more intensely than men do, generally speaking. That's a very generalisation, but that's kind of what we find at the moment. And I imagine it might have been the same in the Troubles or during that period too.
There were also efforts, certainly in the late 19th, early 20th century as well, to really educate women in prison, in mothercraft, to sort of improve their performance, if you like, as mothers. And I think, you know, often the way these classes were given were totally unsympathetic to the way these women had to live their lives. But there was quite a lot of activity in that regard.
Just, I think that conversation is still being had, and I remember the government recently talking about doing that now with women, you know, which is really, it's a really touchy subject, isn't it? Because it's implying that women, especially of a certain class, don't know how to look after their children properly.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you all so much for coming and participating in this. It's really valuable to us to get your feedback on the performance and on the research. And your perspectives on the present day, and some of you are working in the service and as ordinary people. If you haven't already returned your feedback forms, I would really encourage you to do so. That's really helpful. You're a very, very good audience member. Take your name.
If you pointed at me, you can point at you.
Absolutely. And if you want to follow the History Project, we're at histprisonhealth.com. You'll also find us on Twitter with the same handle. And Talking Birds, of course, also have their own website and lots of exciting productions. And they're also supporting, I think, Coventry's bid for...
UK City of Culture 2021. So root for us, please.
Be sure to vote, yes. Okay. Thank you all so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.